Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my email in question. My girlfriend and I listen to you on the radio, and she respects your opinion as I do. So here's the question. I've been separated for 9 months. I'm working on a divorce. Is it okay to date? I believe it is. But she's not comfortable with being around people who know my divorce is not final. Can you help? He kind of answered it when he said, if she's not comfortable, it's not a good gig. And Pat, you have some questions about dating?
I am 58 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I've been divorced for years. I was watching the Oprah show the other day, and they were talking about...
They were talking about sexual desire.
How does that factor in if you're after menopause?
Obviously, being postmenopausal, you know, you aren't going to have the same pheromones, but then the men you're probably going to be dating, they're not going to have that need to mate with you, for children. How do you feel?
How you feel about yourself and your ability to attract others is what this show is all about. Now, I got to tell you, this is a show about sexual addiction, but it's also about sexuality. And what we know to be true is that oftentimes sexuality is a very healthy, normal, natural response to yourself and to others. And sexual addiction isn't. It's compulsive. It's obsessive. It violates boundaries. So that's what we talk about on this show. You know, what is normal and what is abnormal and what do you do about it? And I got to tell you, you know, people that are listening to this show are either potential addicts or addicts that want to know more information, or their partners, and they want to know what to do to make their life better. And for either one, it really requires boundaries. Now, unfortunately, until an addict is in enough trouble, either with their spouse or at work, with their own feelings of low self-esteem and shame, boundaries are probably not going to be manifested in the relationship. Not the kind of boundaries for healthy sexuality and relationship building. You know, I worked with a woman just recently, and she got out of the meadows, and she came home with some strict rules that she was going to follow. And as she got home, her need to intensify her sense of self started to occur, and she started emailing and contacting people only to find out how they were doing and what was going on. Now, that's what the addict was telling her. The addict was saying, you're just calling people to check in. My gosh, you jumped out of their life. The least you can do is fill them in, tell them about what you've been doing, tell them about what you're working on. But we all know that when your relationships are with unhealthy people, they're not going to respect the boundaries. And they're going to look for any opportunity to violate those boundaries. And that's what's happening with her. You know, she is now talking to her pimp and paying him off in money that she believes she owed him because she lost him money while she was at the Meadows. And she borrowed money from her father and her sister to do that. So already she's beginning to cross boundaries. And unfortunately, addiction oftentimes requires intensive treatment, whether that be an intensive outpatient program, whether that means two or three sessions a week, whether that means an intensive inpatient program, transitional living. If your behavior is out of control, it's going to require one, two, if not three, hospitalizations, residential treatments, or workshop series that take you away from your home for anywhere from 3, 5, 7, 12, 15 days. Now, I know that's a real disturbance in your life, but so is the sexual addiction. And tonight, we're going to be talking to Marita Corcoran, and she is the spouse, the partner of a sex addict, and she went through three interventions herself. Three major interventions where she went to two treatment centers and a week-long experience, a workshop situation. So this does affect the whole family. Sometimes kids are involved. Sometimes partners are involved. But everybody has to get healthy. And, you know, I sit in with my clients and I say, you know, if you're this sick, and I put my hand way above my head, your partner is also that sick. We got a sick family system, and somebody has to have boundaries. And let's face it, boundaries are difficult to ascertain. So many people ask, you know, where do I begin setting boundaries with the sex addict? Well, if you've ever read Stephanie Karn's Mending a Shattered Heart, she has guidelines. She says you have the right to not tolerate any unwanted sexual advances. You have the right to expect a commitment to recovery defined by actions, such as a 12-step meeting, and or individual and group psychotherapy. A lot of people that don't believe in God, don't believe in the 12 steps, they work with organizations like Recovery Nation. Had a man today that challenged me. He said, I am pissed off at you, Carol. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord, what I do now? He goes, you keep pushing that 12-step stuff on me. Well, I believe that this man needs face-to-face interaction. He needs support, and he needs it from a variety of people. And in Recovery Nation, he's not going to get that. He's going to get support. He's going to get to talk to somebody. He's going to get homework. He's going to get great, great information to read. I mean, Recovery Nation is a wonderful program, but I believe this man, who is an isolate, who spends his time primarily with himself, unless he's with prostitutes, this guy needs to know what healthy relationships are like. And guys, I got to tell you, guys and women both, that requires face-to-face contact. Call me old-fashioned, I know I probably am, but it requires face-to-face contact. And I maintain that. And so, you know, in AA, you got the 12-step program, but you also have Smart Recovery. And that is a face-to-face where people get together and they talk about cognitive behavioral therapy and they talk about tools they can use. And I'm all for that because they're getting face-to-face interaction with other people. They're getting each other's phone numbers. They're calling each other. They are getting support. And I know that it may seem real safe to do the internet homework and I, you know, I mean, different programs do a good job of maintaining contact with their people, but what I know to be true is that recovery is not about me, the therapist. And it's not about the wife, the husband, the spouse. It's about an entire network, an entire village to raise and reorganize and help to reestablish priorities in an addict's life. Because when that addict changes, then everybody around the addict has to change. So for the woman who's a sex addict and she's missing her pimp, she's missing that domination, or to the man who came back gung-ho from the Meadows and all of a sudden is not going to as many meetings and, boy, he's starting to cancel appointments with me. Work has gotten in the way. And yet he used to say, my recovery is the most important thing. Nothing is going to stand in the way of my recovery. Well, I get that feeling in the pit of my stomach that says, oh, boy, I wish there was more of a network. I wish there was more of a support for this person. I wish people would reach out to him left and right and pull him back into the hard work that recovery takes. Now, if you have a question for myself, the number is 646-595-3284. And I am so excited because we're going to be interviewing Marita Corcoran, and she wrote A House Interrupted, A Wife's Story of Recovery from Her Husband's Sex Addiction. And let me tell you what Melody Beattie said about this book. I mean, can you imagine if Melody Beattie was able to write the foreword to your book? She says, A House Interrupted is a story of extreme betrayal. It moves beyond that to become a story of profound healing. Marita's marriage captures the essence of true forgiveness and hope, reminding us that some things only appear broken beyond compare. And you all remember that Melody Beattie is the author of Codependent No More. In the world of addiction, alcohol, drugs, and sex, wow, she is an incredible pioneer in terms of boundaries and what those look like. And I couldn't put this book down. I got to tell you, I could not put this book down. So I would highly recommend that you write down the number 646-595-3284 and feel free to interrupt us at any point to ask questions, to get information, and to take on whatever information seems to speak to you. Now, what I know to be true is that not a lot of people listen to us live, but boy, they download these episodes. I see it on iTunes, and I see it on Blog Talk Radio. So I know we're doing some good work here, and I know that my experts, my mentors, my colleagues all have a lot to offer, and they're getting their word out, and that's what is so exciting about this work. Because, you know, there's a lot of people that don't really know what to do yet. They don't even know that 12-step programs are around for this. SA, SAA, Al-Anon. They don't know that there are hospitals designated specifically for sexual addiction. And yet what I promise you to be true, and I hate forecasting this, but this is going to be the biggest epidemic that we face in the year 2000, you know, we're not going to see anything bigger than this. Not crack, not cocaine, not heroin, not meth, not bath salts, not any of that stuff. Not gambling, not financial disorders. It's going to be about sex. So I'm really excited to bring this show to you every week. And if you need to email me, you can do that at carolthecoach@aol.com. You can look at my website, and that website is www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach. And if you just want to look at my generalized website, you know, I'm a life coach. I do radio appearances. I've always had radio shows. And I have a lot of hopeful information about how to take your life to the next level. That's www.carolthecoach.com. So clearly, there's lots of ways to ascertain and get information about what you need in your life. And I'm just so thankful to have you here listening to us as well as to our caller. Welcome, Marita. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Carol. Thank you.
Now, I told you, I emailed you and said I was on vacation last week, and I read every word of this book, and I really thought it was fabulous because it really identified your anger, your pain, your disappointment, your disgust. I mean, it just went up and down what I see so many of my partners of addicts going through, and then there was that hopefulness and the recovery and what you needed to do to get healthy. And I just, you're such a role model for anybody who's dealing with this addiction, whether it be the partner or the addict, him or herself.
Well, I appreciate that. I certainly never expected to be where I am today, and that is that our marriage is in a much better, healthier place. I mean, I've got a great marriage today, but as you can tell by reading the book, it took a long time and a lot of hard work on both our parts to get there.
Well, no kidding. I was with a group of 15 to 20 women this week, and I kept stopping them and going, listen to what she says here. Is this not real, and is this not raw? Because truly, you know, when you read some of the stuff that you wrote, you thought, this woman is not going to recover. She is not going to be able to let go of the hurt and the pain. And yet, you did that through taking care of yourself and getting on with your life. So can we start at the beginning? I mean, obviously, you met this guy. He was a lifeguard. What'd you think from the very beginning?
Well, we met in college. He was a senior, and I transferred in as a junior. So I thought he was just, he reminded me, as I write in the book, so much of my father, or what I thought about my father.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that he was smart. He looked like he was going places, and he was driven because he was going to medical school or applying to medical school at that time. He was very athletic. He was dark, tall, dark, and handsome like my dad. So all of those qualities, I thought, wow, he's like my father. So, you know, he can't be all that bad. So we just hit it off. I mean, it wasn't like a magical, this is the guy I'm going to marry kind of thing, but it just felt like a good fit for me.
And you dated for how long before you got married?
We dated on and off for 26 years. I'm 26 years. We dated on and off for almost 8 years.
Right.
And
I know. Wow. That's a long time.
The funny part about that, the funny part is I thought, well, I am not going to be one of those women who gets married to a resident or, someone that's doing his internship only to have him turn around and dump me for a younger woman 20 years down the road. So I thought that I'm going to really get to know this guy, so that's not going to happen to me.
And you didn't necessarily, even though he kind of picked you up with a pickup line, I mean,
right,
when you think back, what was it that he said to you that was kind of a pickup line?
One of the things that I just couldn't believe he said was he was taunting me a little bit about my name, my nickname. And so right at the very start of our banter back and forth, it was kind of like we were kind of taunting each other almost.
Mm-hmm.
And
that is fun to banter back and forth. That's a great way to flirt because
sure,
it's an indirect way of flirting.
Right, exactly. So that's how our relationship started out, and we actually went out that evening, and then we were pretty much together for that whole entire year. I don't think I dated anybody else. It was just, we were just very exclusive.
And during that time of courtship, which you said was 8 years or so, you had no idea that he was having multiple affairs on you.
I had absolutely no idea. And a large part of that time was spent apart. I mean, he went out of the country to medical school, so I only saw him maybe 2 or 3 months out of the year. during probably a 2.5 to 3 year period until he transferred back to the United States in Baltimore. So we just decided our mindset was during all this time before we got engaged, where it was, I don't care what you do when you're not with me, but when you're with me, you know, we're exclusive and you can't flaunt anybody in your face. I mean, he knew that I was seeing other people, and he, you know, I knew he was seeing other people. I just didn't know the extent of what he was doing.
Right. And so tell us a little bit about how he confessed to you that he needed help, that he needed to go into treatment.
Well, the whole thing kind of just the last straw for me was there were a period of a couple of years leading up to his going into rehab where I started to feel very uneasy, and we were arguing about his inaccountability of time. And I think for someone that has a profession like a doctor who is always on call, who is always doing rounds at the hospital, who's dictating charts, they have a huge amount of their lives that are unaccountable, that no one knows if they really are doing what they're doing. Now, I have never been around someone that lied so much and was living a double life, so I had no clue. I would never have thought that he was lying to me. So, I started having to take more control over our family and the situation at home, our finances, leading up to his going into rehab. And finally, at a trip out to a wedding, his behavior was just so flirtatious and outrageous and absolutely so disrespectful to me that I just went, I don't want to be with a man that does this kind of stuff. So that was, in a nutshell, what really forced me to really see the light, that something was really wrong. I did not know what it was, but I just didn't want to be a part of that anymore.
So you made that decision that you didn't want to be with a man like that, and then what happened?
Well, he actually did not, I mean, he says that he knew what he was, you know, that he was, of course, had a problem, a sexual problem, but he really didn't put all the pieces together. And at that time, too, I don't think the word sexual addiction was so much out there. So what I did was I decided that on the way back from that trip where I just had enough of him, I said, you have 2 weeks to get out, to find some help or get out. I'm not living with you like this anymore. So he did do that, and he found a place actually online where it was specific to professionals. It was run actually by a recovering addict himself who was also a physician. And so he sought treatment at the Menninger Clinic, which is now at Baylor in Houston, or in Texas, but it was at that time in Kansas.
Yeah, and that was really interesting because you've heard of the Menninger Clinic, but I had no idea that they had at least a couple of experts on sexual addiction. When I was reading the advice he was getting, you were getting, I thought, these guys are right on, and this is, what, 1997?
Yeah, we were just very fortunate because originally my husband's therapist wanted him to go to the Meadows.
The Meadows, which is the
Meadows or Sierra Tucson even. And, and my husband knew, this is a sexual thing. I need to find something else. And so he researched and he found someone that he connected to, he called and spoke to him, is Dr. Richard Irons, who has unfortunately passed away a number of years ago. But at that time, you know, my husband clicked from the beginning, and so my husband decided, well, this might be the guy that will, you know, tell me what's wrong with me. So he decided, he did go to the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas.
And I loved how you identified chapters based on what had happened. For example, chapter 2 is the disclosure. And for anybody who's listening that doesn't know that much about sexual addiction, the disclosure is obviously when you hear from your partner what their addiction is like, what they have done, who it's involved, how much it's involved their life. And it really is a shock, a psychological shock to your soul. You had no idea that it was as extensive. You knew that he had humiliated you and been inappropriate.
Right.
But you had no idea.
No, I had no idea. I would have bet money on it. And people that knew us and our close friends would have bet money on the fact that he would never have cheated, that he would never have crossed the line. And so that's why it was just so stunning, and it was just so devastating to hear that he had been living a complete double life, our entire relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And the disclosure, it was funny, since they asked him not to do that at Menninger. They said, wait till she comes out for family week before you tell her anything. Do not tell her anything over the phone.
Right, because he deserves support, and you deserve support.
Exactly. They said this is too much for her to handle. She has no background in any of this. And he couldn't keep it in. He couldn't sleep. He was now a week and a half into his treatment. He was at that time, as they say, sexually sober in every sense of the word, and he just could not live with the guilt. So he called and did that. And it was, you know, that was part of that phone call, and the things that I found out just from that night are certainly part of my post-traumatic stress that I had to deal with later on into my treatment.
Oh, absolutely. Ongoing. I mean, that post-traumatic stress. I can imagine that. And, you know, you said that he asked you to read Dr. Patrick Carn's book, Out of the Shadows.
Right.
Which is obviously one of the Bibles of sexual addiction. And you said, I didn't want to have to read something so dark and sick. You know, you couldn't figure out why would he have you read something so ugly.
Yeah. No, I couldn't imagine it. I mean, I never heard of that. And then when I thought, how can that be an addiction? And when I was reading it, I'm like, ew, that's gross. Mm-hmm. What is this?
Well, and then you consulted with your brother David, who had been through so much pain himself in your own family.
Yes, and he was great. I mean, because he lives in New York City, so he did have some friends that have been in recovery, and so he was the only one that I knew of anyone that ever talked about knowing anybody in recovery. And
right,
so
I think being out in New York, he was more sexually sophisticated anyway. As well as he was gay, and that in and of itself can lend itself to some sexually promiscuous behavior until you figure out what you want in life.
Yeah, so I felt very at ease saying, you know, have you ever heard of this? And he's like, oh yeah, I've heard of people talk about that. He said, I wouldn't worry about it, it's probably just the masturbating.
Right.
That was what his comment.
He minimized it too. And yet, again, you were so lucky to have David, because truly...
Yeah.
He was there for you 24/7.
No, he's a great brother, I'll tell you. So, and has been and always will. But,
and I love that interchange between you and David and your father. Because not only did you have the drama of your husband being a sexual addict, and you know, you describe your husband throughout the entire book as... One minute, he's really trying, and I am just right there with him, and I'm going, oh, please, Marita, please just accept this and this positivity. He's trying, and then the next minute he'd be cold and aloof, and he would put you down, and so you're dealing with that, and then you've got your own family drama with your extended family, your mother, your father, your brother. And I thought, how much can this woman take?
Yeah. No, it's really, I mean, that's why I thank goodness for doing the recovery work. Really, I mean, I went into recovery to save myself, not my marriage, not my husband, just me, to get my feet back on the ground. And one of the great things that I have learned so much about recovery is that all of these principles that you learn about just filters into everything. It filters into how to deal better with your own family. Or your siblings, or your friendships. I mean, it's just such a wonderful experience to get into this world of recovery. So, because it just has helped me in so many different aspects of my life, especially when I had to deal with the impending death of my father and watching all of my siblings and my mother react so differently than I did, because I had new tools to deal with, to deal with.
Right, and your mom basically checked out because that's all she knew how to do.
Right.
And you were really there for your father. And I loved your humor. You know, for anybody who's listening, Marita spent part of the book making fun of us therapists. She'd say, that's goofy, silly shit. I don't understand why they're doing that. Or, oh, they just want us to sit around and beat pillows. And
yep.
I just loved, you know, your take on how foreign this seems when you're in so much pain.
Right.
You know, to write a letter to your father, to get your anger out, to wear your wedding ring again. I mean, you really, you were in culture shock, if nothing else, from the therapy.
Right. Well, it's a whole different world, and because I was so emotionally traumatized, especially at the very beginning, I hung on my therapist every word. I mean, he was my salvation. I mean, it was the only place very early on, probably the first 2 or 3 years, where I felt safe, where
mm-hmm.
I felt like everything is okay as long as I'm in this room with this therapist, because it's the only place where anything ever made any sense.
Well, and he did a beautiful job of being right where you were at and helping support you, but he also represented all the other good things that were going on, or the change or the progress, not perfection, or your marriage, the hope for the marriage, when you didn't want to trust that. You had been so blindsided and so hurt.
Right.
That, you know, that he really was kind of that star. And
right.
So when he started to move away from you and suggest that maybe you didn't need him anymore, or maybe you need marital counseling with somebody else, I knew that had to be a hard time for you.
Oh, it was terrible. I was like, what? You know, I don't know. Because what you know, I went from being a woman that I thought was running a household efficiently and, you know, had a good life, to having nothing, to having everything die, and to go, you must be the biggest idiot on the planet because of what's happened behind your back. So I didn't trust myself. I didn't trust in anything. And so I had to rebuild that all over again. And so, and this person, this therapist, was a very safe person for me to do it with. And so when you're in that intense situation for a long period of time and you start coming out of it, that's your safety net, because no one else is safe around you. Except
and
for
I
that.
Know I'm biased since I'm a certified sexual addictions therapist, right. But I was so glad that so was he, you
yeah.
know, because nothing seemed to shock him. He knew what to expect, and he knew what you were going through. He'd seen it before.
Yeah, and that's what I think is absolutely so important in what I've seen since meeting so many other women that are dealing with this, that I was just so, both my husband and I were just so fortunate to have someone right out of the gate who was helping us navigate this sexual addiction stuff. Because I have heard of women that have come into Essanon, which is for spouses and family members of sex addicts, that's our support group, and they've wallowed in nowhere land with therapists who are not trained in this. And
no.
who don't see the impact of what this does to a spouse until they find someone that's really trained in it, they just don't seem to do as well. So I think that having a therapist that knows, that is trained in the sexual addiction field, is really, really important.
Well, I do too. And, you know, equally important, you know, I felt for you, because clearly you were going to some groups that really made a lot of sense. But I got to tell you, I don't want to offend anybody out there, but when I get a sex addict that wants to go to a Celebrate Recovery group, I'm like, that's recovery light. You need to be going to SAA or SA. You, mm-hmm. you know, you can go to that group, but you got to go to more than that. And truly, it was neat to read how Celebrate Recovery was a very safe and helpful place for you.
Right. It really was.
I was very impressed.
And one of the things that now I haven't been to Celebrate Recovery in a number of years, but
right.
that was a wonderful addition to our recovery, because first of all, the pastor that we had at our church, who was in charge of all of this, he said, I would love for you to start a group. You can do it. You can call it whatever you want. You can do whatever you want, but you can come under our umbrella. So I was very fortunate with that, because in Celebrate Recovery, they do actually now have groups that deal with codependency and the spouses of sex addicts.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't when I was going there, but they do have that now.
Yeah, they don't have that here in Indy, so I'm glad to hear that it's other places.
Oh, sure, sure. So that, but and that just took it to a different level and a different atmosphere than a regular Essanon meeting. So I think that, you know, that if you have those in your community, I think it's a great resource. That's, to me, that's what it was just a great resource, another place to go to heal. And my husband, it was something that we could do together, too.
Well,
go
and I really admired the fact that you actually, because I'm always talking to women about this, you started your own COSA group, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you
yeah.
start with three women, two women, or three women?
Well, actually, it started with one woman that I met in Al-Anon. It was I chaired an Al-Anon meeting, and I said, I want to talk about infidelity that goes along sometimes with, you know, AA. Because AA is so strict about, and Al-Anon, they're very strict about, you only talk about the alcoholic. You don't talk about any other addiction in that group. So, but a woman in her 60s came up to me after I talked about that, and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, I just found out my husband of 48 years is looking at pornography. Let's, you know, can we get together? And that's how really the group started.
Mm-hmm.
And then she brought a friend from New York that happened to be coming through, who had been actually to an Essanon meetings in New York. So when I came back from the Meadows, I brought the COSA stuff with me, and we started our group. And we used to meet in the Pancake House.
Right.
And
there is this belief that to start a group, you just need two people.
Sure.
So here you were. You had three. Besides yourself?
One other woman and I met for two or three weeks, and then she brought another woman. So then there were three of us, and that's how it started.
Well, yeah. It was so interesting to see your journey, because obviously Marita was a woman who had so much anger that she was unable to see any of the good that was really coming into her life. And so her therapists and her mentors and her sponsors, Gail, whatever, they all encouraged her to continue to go to treatment, not to deal with him, but to deal with you.
Yeah.
And I can imagine what an assault that felt like, because you're thinking, me, I'm not the one with the flipping problem.
Right.
But truly, it was your problem, too. Can you tell our audience how it ended up being your problem, too?
Well, what I think is so great about a group like Essanon or COSA is that it forces you to take the focus off what was done to you, which was my husband's infidelity and sexual addiction, and focus on you, my choices, my behavior, my reactions, and how to turn that around and do it healthier.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, is really what that's all about. And then, of course, through therapy, I found out, well, there's a reason why you married a sex addict, and here are some of the reasons that probably led you into this path of meeting Brian. So, and, you know, all of these things about the anger and actually the rage, what I didn't have was anger, it was actually rage. You know, I grew up with a raging mother. So, you know, regardless of what Brian does to me, how do I react? I react in a raging, angry manner. And certainly his betrayal and the sexual addiction part blew that off the lid. So there's a lot of things that I, surprise, surprise, that I had to look at for myself. So it's such a great growth experience. It doesn't feel like that at the beginning, because it's so easy for women like me to point the finger because his behavior is so egregious and you can see it. You couldn't see my dysfunction, but you could definitely identify my husband's because of what he did.
Well, and share with the audience just some of the things that you were dealing with, because I'm sure a lot of them haven't read the book, and so they're wondering, Was it prostitution? Was it voyeurism? Was it pornography? What was it?
Well, he was dealing pretty much with pornography and anonymous sex, and that is with prostitutes, with strippers, and with other sex addicts that he would meet in bars. And it, when I say anonymous, faceless sex, it means that he did not tell anyone his name. He never used his full name or anything, and he didn't even want to know the other woman's name. He could have cared less. These relationships lasted maybe 30 minutes tops. He never saw the same person twice. It was just faceless, anonymous sex. That was it. And so to understand that, I thought, you know, because it went on for so long and because there were over 100 sexual encounters, this is not some guy just having a middle-aged breakdown, turning 40 and sowing his wild oats. This is something off the charts that was sick, because a lot of his sexual acting out was done with no protection, which means I would say 90% of his sexual acting out was done without condoms, which put him at risk, certainly, me at risk, and all of our children at risk. So that in itself was like, this is really sick. This is off the chart kind of stuff. So, and that kind of made me understand a little bit more that this is really not just a guy, you know, going through a midlife crisis. This is really sick. I mean, this guy's trying to kill himself, and he could take his wife and his kids with him. So.
Yeah, and there were constant tests, HIV tests that you had to take, because it didn't just require one. You had to go back for six
right.
months at a time. And if I'm remembering correctly, he did have one slip. Is
he
that
did.
Correct?
He did.
So it started the whole thing over again in terms of the yes.
And what happened was that brought us right back to the brink, because they say, what we were told in recovery at the very, actually when I went to see him in Menninger, Dr. Iron said, you know, you've got a 95% chance of a relapse within 5 years and a 98% chance of failure for your marriage to make it up to 5 years. So those are not good statistics. I know that they're improved today, but back then that was what he told me. But we had made it to the five-year mark with no relapse. My husband relapsed five years and 3 months. So we didn't get that. But, yeah, so but that brought us right back to the brink of divorce, just right back. And but the difference was that he had, before he told me about the relapse, he and my his therapist had everything in place. I, of course, have new recovery friends. I had a new spiritual foundation, so I didn't fall as hard. It wasn't as painful, and I was able to forgive him so much faster.
Well, and that whole spirituality piece was instrumental in getting you through the roughest part of that, and it really did help you to learn how to detach. It wasn't about you, it was about him.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that spiritual piece, I mean, I just feel so lucky because I was, you know, I came to that. That was the that was the missing piece of my puzzle. I had a great therapist. I had a good recovery resource for groups, but I needed that spirituality piece, and that was absolutely critical. So with all three of those big elements, that is how I really got a chance to get back on my feet and to recover from the absolute trauma and pain of this addiction.
Well, and I know everybody's journey is different, and certainly you had more money than a lot of the couples that I work with, although money became an issue, and there were times when you had to liquidate everything
right.
to just make it that following week. So it's not like you were on gravy train 100% of the time, but you definitely did, wasn't it three programs? It was you did on-site, and you
yeah.
did the Meadows.
Right. I went, and we did another thing. I did another thing called Odyssey out in Oh, that was out in Arizona as well. So, no, we were very, very, very fortunate that we had the wherewithal to pay for really top-notch therapy, no doubt about it. We were very, very fortunate for that.
But that had to feel ironic that here you are, the partner, and you're actually undergoing more intensive treatment than your husband did. Because he went to Menninger, and then where else did he go? He went somewhere else, right?
He went to Menninger for 3.5 months, and then he did one of the on-site weeks as well. He did that, and then he also went on a lot of the men's retreats, you know, the retreats that I went on with my therapist, Harold. He did a lot of those as well with Harold, with a group of men.
Right.
So,
yeah, that Harold did everything, didn't he? Including cut that chair up to find your ring.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. See, that was one of the funny parts about, I mean, just when you think you can't do anything anymore, something absurd happens that really makes you laugh and brings some things back into reality. Like, it's not all bad and horrible and doom and gloom. There are some funny parts that you can see. So,
well, funny but ironic. For anybody who hasn't read the book, Harold keeps telling her she needs to wear her ring again. You know, that is a symbol of their marriage, and she's not wearing it. And if I may be so bold, Marita, it seemed like you not wearing it was obviously a direct reflection of your anger and of your inability to admit that you were still married. I mean, this was your way of saying, you know what, the jury's still out on this. I'm not sure what I'm going to do here.
That's exactly right. That piece about wearing the ring, I did not feel married.
Right.
When that happened to me, I felt nothing for him except anger and resentment. I didn't feel love. I didn't want to present to the world that we were married. I had a very hard time going anywhere with him or being seen with him in public for a very long time because I did not want people to look at us and say, oh, look at that nice couple. Because we weren't.
You didn't want to create that illusion that had been created for so long to you.
Exactly. And that's why I feel, you know, a lot of people when celebrities or famous people get busted for this, like the, I remember that the woman who was married to Elliot Spitzer, and she was up there with that famous picture of her just looking so shell-shocked. And she got you know, people kind of put her down for standing up there, and I'm thinking they have no idea what they're talking about because she looks like she's in total shock, just doesn't know what's coming, and she's just doing it probably for her family, for her children, because she had children behind there. So you just don't know how you're going to feel and how you're going to react. And as you said, you know, everyone's story is different. I just could not stomach wearing a wedding ring and seeing what that meant and then knowing what he did. And my heart had not healed enough yet as to be his wife. I didn't know if we were going to make it or not. So I didn't
want... Then you had that period of closeness where you really did have a wonderful interlude. And to reflect that, you two went out and bought a new ring, just a little gold band that symbolized your new marriage.
Right. Yep, we did that.
So Marita is wearing this ring in her session, and she's kind of playing with it and fumbling around, and she loses it in her therapist's couch. Or no, chair.
His couch.
Was it a couch? And the only way she could really get it back, because remember, this is a man who's been bugging her, you put that ring on, you keep that ring on, you need to wear that ring. And, of course, this was the old ring, and now she had the new ring. So he had to actually cut the couch to go through the back of it to figure out where was the ring because it was caught inside. And you said he was mumbling under his breath, and I was laughing so hard because it showed the humanness of a therapist. And you said, I really think I got on his last nerve, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure I did. I'm sure.
Well, it was kind of, I'm sure you got on his last nerve, but I'm sure he got on his own last nerve. He goes, damn it, I'm sure he was sitting there thinking, I had to have her get this damn ring, and now I am ripping my own couch apart to find this ring for her. I mean, it was just hilarious. Your sense of humor in this was just delightful. So, you know, what I love the most about the book is that you're so hateful, you're so ugly, you're so angry, you're so pissed, you're so hostile, you're so hurt, you're so pained. You know, the words go on and on about what you were, and it is like Melody Beatty said that at the end, it really glorifies hope. How did you turn it around to find the love again?
Yeah,
because you said I didn't even want to be seen with him.
Yeah, I think just seeing him, just seeing him work so hard. I mean, I can't imagine when I look back on it, even though as certainly at the beginning he deserved the animosity and the anger for what
and
he did.
And the consequences.
Yeah, so, you know, to live with that day after day after day, and he's in the throes of his own recovery and trying to stay sober and do all the stuff that he had to do and then come home to that, seeing him not give up, seeing him still go to his meetings, seeing him now start reaching out to other people that were struggling with it, that and his building back my trust. He's totally accountable with his time and where he's going and what he's doing, so much so that I stopped asking him years ago because it's just a given now. I mean, everything that I've asked him to do, he's done. And I think also getting straight with my spiritual program again and coming to terms with my higher power and claiming a higher power and realizing that, you know, this sexual addiction is in my life for a reason, and it doesn't really have a lot to do about Brian. Brian's just the catalyst about all of this. This has to do with me and my higher power. So I think that all of those things combined really start letting me see him, the man. I was able to start seeing the man instead of being able to separate the disease from the man. And that's not who he is. I mean, he certainly has a problem with that and has had a problem with it and probably will always continue to struggle in some way with his sexual addiction. But for right now, he is a man that is walking really strong in his recovery. And he has earned my trust back, and he has earned my love again. So
is he going to be speaking at the SASH conference? Because I saw that you're going to be speaking.
Yes, he's coming. We're doing it together.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yep.
For anybody who doesn't know, the SASH conference is a specific conference for sexual advancement of sexual health. And I saw where you're going to be speaking, and I thought, again, this is excellent, because I am going to have every partner I know read this book, because it really encapsulates their anger mm-hmm. and then the recovery that comes from that. And, you know, if you told me 2 years from now that you ended up divorcing, I would know that you two did that out of mutual respect for each other.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's because truly you have accepted where each one was
uh-huh.
and where you're going. I mean, the acceptance is so prevalent in the end of this book.
Yeah, and that's what's so wonderful about the, you know, we see each other really with who we are. He's seen me through my, you know, my down times and my bad times and whatever, and I've certainly seen him at his worst. And we still look at each other and love each other and care. We really care about each other as human beings. So that's the wonderful part. We're looking at each other and we're seeing the truth. We weren't doing that up until all this happened.
Well, and you found yourself, because truly, because of your age and your own development, you never really got to hone in on who you were spiritually, emotionally, creativity-wise. You just didn't know, and you really got to evolve that, and when that evolved,
mm-hmm.
you got more confident, and the more confident you got, then the less likely he was to affect you. You knew it was about him. It wasn't about you.
Right. And that's really critical, and that's what I love, that aspect of talking to other women about this, is that I don't, you know, I can understand because of, again, because of all the therapy I've had, how I lost myself. But I started losing the young woman that I was even before I met my husband. That started, I think, in high school, in junior high. I started just getting a little bit, you know, letting little bits of things that happened just tear at my spirit as a young girl. And then I think that I was losing myself all the way through junior high, high school. And so when I met my husband, a big part of me was already gone. And I never knew that. I thought I was, you know, easygoing and spontaneous and fun-loving and, you know, was known as someone that will, you know, do anything or go anywhere at a moment's notice. And, you know, that really, that's what it looked like on the outside, but that was not what was really going on the inside. I had no idea what I was doing or where I was going.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I really believe that the wake-up calls, obviously, was when you delved into the spirituality and you had Gail as your spiritual director, and also how you began to see how both of you had affected your kids, especially your oldest.
Right.
And that was a wake-up call, it seemed like, for you, that you had to surrender the anger and just...
Right.
And take on a new life.
Right.
Can you
share
with our listening audience, what do you think children should be told depending on their ages?
Well, the way it was told to me, and I think that it makes perfect sense, is I think that any of the sexual stuff, especially like the infidelity and all of that, I don't think, in my opinion, and it was told to me that kids should not know that till at least they're 16 years old. That
mm-hmm.
seems... I've heard that twice, both from my therapist, and then not even say prostitute or anything like that, just infidelity or adultery,
mm-hmm.
or I wasn't respectful to your mother in a way that I should have been, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
As they get older, they'll start to ask, you know, themselves. But unfortunately, when our oldest was 13, she's now going to be 28, but when she was 13, my husband picked her up at school one day, and she asked him, she said, "Dad, did you cheat on Mom?" And he said, "Yes."
Mm-hmm.
And that threw her, that threw her into a tailspin.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been with her now forever. I mean, it will be with her forever because she was too young to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has been actually in therapy a couple of times dealing with this, of course. And the good thing is we're not making fun of therapy anymore. We know exactly how wonderful and what a great resource therapists are. So our children know that they, at any time when they feel like they need to get things back on track, therapists are always there as a valuable resource for them. So... but telling the kids, I just think that the older they get, as they found out more,
mm-hmm.
they went through all their periods at different times of being very resentful and very disrespectful to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls were also disrespectful to me because they couldn't understand why I stayed. So, again, just as my husband had to earn his respect back for me, he had to earn his respect back with the kids.
You got it.
Yeah, so that's so important. I've heard so many women tell us horror stories about what they've told their young children. And, you know, these are our adult problems. Adult problems don't belong on children's shoulders. So I'm real big because I know that. I spent a lot of my recovery repairing the wounds of my childhood, and yet I've turned around and wounded my own children.
Well, I think we all do, and the good news is that they develop resilience and strength as a result, as long as it's handled properly. Now, Marita, we have to end, so I want to remind everybody, her book is called A House Interrupted. It's a wife's story of recovery from her husband's sexual addiction, and, you know, you can get this book at Amazon and through Gentlepath, and is it at Barnes & Noble?
It is. It's at Barnes & Noble and Books A Million. It's a Target. And I have my website, too, ahouseinterrupted.com. So it's pretty easy to get.
Excellent. So they can contact you through that website, ahouseinterrupted.com. And thank you so much for being available to my listening audience. The book was a pleasure to read and very insightful.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Good luck to you. And if there's any way I can ever help you, you keep my email close.
I will. Thank you so much, Carol. Have a nice night.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And as I end the show, every week, I want to tell you, there will only be one of you at all times. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week when we learn more about the Meadows and other treatment centers for sexual addicts. Have a great week.